after a substantial layoff, done a lot of traveling. Tim, you were just back home. How was that?
Back home in St. Louis was very nice. Humidity, just getting going there. Hey, it's the Midwest. You know, what are you going to do Midwest in the summertime? My mom yesterday was already here. It's kind of overcast and been cloudy and a little bit drizzly for a few days. High temperatures maybe topping out in the coastal areas where you are over there, 60s, 70s where I am. Maybe 75 in St. Louis, 98 degrees, 100%.
Holy cow, really? That hot?
Already.
Oh, wow.
Already. Yeah, you're not even summer yet, but whatever. That's what it was. A lot of fun. My mom's 80th birthday, so hey, Mom.
Fantastic. Congratulations, Mom. That's pretty great. That's great stuff. Well, we were just in New York, and it was the most beautiful weather. I didn't want to come back because it's better than California.
Yeah, I mean, it
was fantastic. We had a three-hour-long meeting in Central Park, and people were playing and jogging and just picnicking, and it was amazing. It was sunny and beautiful. It really it's a wonderful time in New York right now.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, and we were also in Europe some weeks ago during spring break, and I can't believe we're already talking about last spring break. and I was able to pick up some 4Ks that are not available here, which made me very happy, including The Elephant Man.
Oh.
And what else did I get there on 4K? I've got them sitting around here somewhere. Hold on. Let's see. Yeah.
Elephant Man. Gorgeous. Black and white.
The Elephant Man and, oh gosh. I got them. I can't even remember the rest of them, but I jumped all over them. It was a bunch of great 4Ks. I'm like, we don't have those yet. So The Elephant Man was the big one for me. Yeah. Let's go through some of the obits. Norman Reynolds died. Norman Reynolds, the famous Spielberg affiliated production designer of Empire of the Sun and many other great things.
Great Britain, yeah.
They don't kind of make them like that anymore. They're all CG people now. Norman Reynolds actually built stuff.
Yeah. 1934, Norman, just really one of the old school guys, Raiders, all that kind of stuff. I mean, he built stuff. It's funny. We used to talk about this all the time, frankly. There was that moment, because you and I are from that era, too. Not as old as Norman here, but we're from that era of where we grew up watching films that were made by guys like Norman.
And so
those are our movies, right? And it's just interesting because Raiders is back, as you know, or will be here in a second. And the first Raiders is one of Norman's. And you watch that movie and you see all that stuff in that movie that's actually stuff.
Yeah.
That boulder rolling down all stuff, and I haven't seen the new movie, but I'm kind of thinking there's not going to be any stuff in that movie.
I'm thinking
there's going to be no stuff in that movie at all.
It's stuff that comes out of a computer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then speaking of Spielberg, we also lost Bill Butler, who was over 100 years old.
Bill Butler.
Yeah, he was 101. He was 101.
Crazy.
1921. Bill. Crazy. Yeah. He, Jaws, The Conversation. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He kind of defined the 70s in many respects.
Yeah. And again, one of these guys who, worked his whole entire life, career, in actual film, format of actual film, and had to understand all of that. And I got to think, some of that's going to go away, dude. I mean, cats in, film school today, I suppose classes where they work with actual film are electives.
Yeah.
I'm thinking. I mean, I don't. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, right? I mean, why would you have? Why would it be just the thing that you're doing in film school today, studying cinematography? Of course, if you're in film school today studying cinematography, why would you touch film other than as an elective? But it's what he did the whole damn time.
Grease. He shot Grease. Yeah. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if you shot Jaws and Grease, it's done. But I mean, I'm just looking at the rest of his films. I mean, Deliverance.
Yeah. The Rain People.
He did second unit on The Godfather. It's just unreal. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And all kinds of films too, you know, not just genre films, dramas where people were just sitting and talking, you know, horror movies.
He did Hot Shots in 1991.
Yeah.
You know, he did the original Child's Play. I mean, really all across the board, you know, it's really amazing. And Rocky III, one of my favorite Rockies. I mean, it has my favorite montage in it.
Oh boy.
Stripes. Amazing. Legendary guy. Anaconda. Legendary guy.
Which is what you're
going to call. Gosh, right? Yeah. Anaconda. Good heavens. Anyway. And then, we also lost Harry Belafonte, who I know is a near and dear to you and a legendary figure, socially, cinematically, you know, the pride of the Caribbean. To many people, talk about Harry, man, and what he meant. I mean, that's a guy who I think dwelt in, unfortunately, in the shadow of Sidney Poitier for far too long, even though they were good friends. But he was kind of seen as, you know, both of them Caribbean, both of them coming up at a time when it was difficult for black actors. And I think he was kind of pigeonholed under that umbrella, but he did his own thing.
He did. And that's the most important thing. You know, Harry was honored by the Academy a couple of years ago, and I had a chance to chit chat with him then, as well as a very, very, very long time ago, in a junket for a film that he did with John Travolta. Dustin Nguyen film. What was the name of that film? It'll pop in my head in a second. That movie, White Man's Burden.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right.
1995 or so. So, you know, actually bumped into him a few times. And Harry would have said, often said that he didn't feel that he was in Sidney's shadow at all. Indeed, very often, the films that Sidney did and received accolades for were films that they came to Harry with, and he turned them down. And did not regret.
So interesting.
Turned down Lilies of the Field. Turned him down. He said, I could not figure out why that brother was out there singing songs with those German nuns. I couldn't figure it out. but Sidney figured it out. So while they were on the same path in terms of what they were attempting to do with their careers, they took different routes to do it. But sometimes they crossed over. Buck and the Preacher. 1970.
I know. That's
Harry,
the one.
Harry and Sidney. Sidney ostensibly directing that film, although I think Joe Sargent directed most of that movie. But whatever. Sidney Poitier's directorial would be him and Harry Belafonte. And what's funny is their characters in their film sort of reflect them. Harry playing that loudmouth asshole preacher. And Sidney playing this upright guy, wagon trail guy, gonna lead his people out west. It's literally them, but they're both doing the exact same thing in that movie. That movie didn't get a lot of love back in the day, but you gotta return to that movie and see it. It's prescient.
No, it's on Criterion now, and it deserves to be. It is a landmark and milestone film for sure.
Yeah,
Harry deeply missed, but what a full life. Really, a very, very full life. You can't say that he was taken before his time. He made the most of every second. Speaking of Jim Brown, recently, you know, I know we all got very mixed feelings about Jim, who has an ugly history with women, but who also is an undeniable seminal figure, because he was the first athlete to figure out that when you retired as an athlete, you could start as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And so many others followed in his footsteps. Fred Williamson, you know, jumped right into that and then became a producer on top of that. But Williamson did it. It was Jim Brown who did it first. Rosie Greer. You know, some freaking Mike Tyson is in a movie, a French movie this week, you know. There are so many athletes who've made that jump, but Jim Brown did it first.
Yeah. I mean, look, in a certain way, you can connect that move to Arnold Schwarzenegger, from bodybuilder to actor, and
absolutely,
and all kinds of folks.
Without Jim Brown, there is no Schwarzenegger. There's no doubt about it.
Hell, our good buddy Sherman Augustus played with the San Diego Chargers and the Vikings in the '80s and late '80s, and because of what Jim Brown had done 20 years ago, knew that he could make that transition. All you had to do was was be good at it. It's funny. We talk about Jim Brown, you know, a difficulty. To be honest, I have no trouble talking about Jim Brown at all. His whole career, his whole life, everything he did, even the nutty, wacky, crack crap that he did with women in his life. Jim Brown's a man born in 1936. That's a long time ago. And he was a man who was Gullah Geechee. Jim Brown was from them islands off South Carolina. The interesting thing about the folks who grew up off those islands, South Carolina, is that they grew up in a fairly isolated community where much of the machinations of the United States at that time, race and racial divides and issues like that, did not affect them because there weren't no white people around. It's just plain and simple. So Jim Brown grew up with a sort of manly dynamic and attitude that one might associate with figures like John Wayne and John Ford, folks like that who simply just never had around him the sort of notion that he needed to be subservient to anybody. And he lived his whole entire life that way, sometimes to his detriment. But this is the thing that I'll say about Jim Brown. Jim Brown took responsibility for every daggum stupid thing that he did. It was funny. You go to Jim Brown and say, Jim, they say you you threw a lady off the balcony. Well, I did throw off the balcony, and I probably shouldn't have done that, but I did it. And I should probably take the punishment for that. Well, you know, Jim, we're gonna go ahead and punish you for that. And he would go ahead and take his punishment for it. You didn't see Jim, you know, sort of whining and any of that stuff. He just took the hit for what he did, and then he tried to be better.
And his interviews are really, really very interesting. I mean, he's one of those guys who, I mean, look, I've interviewed Fred Williamson.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that Fred Williamson learned two lessons from Jim Brown. Because I think they played together, didn't they? They played opposite each other at the time. Yeah.
Little tiny overlap. Yeah.
Yeah. And what he learned from Jim Brown, number one, was never lie in an interview. Always be transparent, because if you lie in an interview, the press person is going to see right through you. They're going to know you're feeding them a line. But the other thing he learned from Jim Brown was do it with some grace.
Yeah.
Because Jim didn't always do it with grace. Jim would just kind of lay it out there. It'd sometimes be like a shock. It'd like somebody throwing a dagger in your face. Be like, holy cow, did he really just say that? And Fred is just, you know, Fred comes with the props. Fred comes with the cigar. He dresses the part. He knows how to, you know, Fred is just smooth as silk. And interviewing Fred, you know, every line is like a drop of honey. And with Jim, every line was like, you know, it was like a shuriken. It was like a throwing star.
Oh.
And
Fred was uptown. Jim was downtown.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good way of putting it.
That's what that was. But uptown learned how to roll from downtown.
Yeah,
exactly. The other thing I was saying about Jim Brown is in terms of being an athlete, a movie star, an athlete who engaged himself in activism, sometimes we forget about that. Jim Brown precedes just about everybody there, save Paul Robeson.
Yeah.
You got Paul Robeson, and then you got Jim Brown. You just got to go far enough back to understand that Jim Brown from day one, even in college, was already engaged in the activism that we sort of think about. And sometimes that gets lost in the midst of all those other things that we just spoke about. But, you know, that's probably OK. But I remember Jim Brown was always there.
And lastly, your hometown girl, Tina Turner. I think that was a shock. I mean, I know she was, you know, 83 or whatever it was, but I think, you know, look, I reviewed that Tina Turner doc on Film Week last year.
Yeah.
And it's just filled with interviews with her, fresh interviews from last year. And she looked as spry and as alert and as healthy as ever, and living in Switzerland and just, you know, eating well. And she just looked great. And I came out of that thinking, oh, the girl's going to be around for, we got to have at least another decade with Tina. So I didn't see this coming. But I know for St. Louis, I know she means something special.
Well, we call her Anna Mae Bullock over there. My mama went to high school with Tina Turner. My mama and all her sisters went to high school with Tina Turner and her sisters. My mother, when Tina Turner was a little girl, 13, 14 years old, was Tina's hairdresser in Nutbush, Tennessee. All of these people are from Tennessee, and they all more or less sort of immigrated up to St. Louis from the South during that period, late 50s, early 60s, late to the late 60s. And Tina would have been a junior when my mother was a freshman. And my mother does the most dead-on Tina Turner impersonation. And I'm like, Mom, if you could sing like that, damn it. What the hell are you doing over here? Anyway, it was just so that's a thing. And Tina was always great. She was always a hometown girl, thus that record, Nutbush, Tennessee. And her whole entire story back in 90, I guess it was two or three. What's Love Got to Do With It? That movie about her life with Angela Bassett playing Tina Turner was just this astounding thing. Lawrence Fishburne playing Ike Turner was just this astounding thing. And, you know, it helped in the even further relaunching of her career, which had already been relaunched in the middle 80s. And of course she had that iconic role in Thunderdome with one of the few movies from that era where that song, we don't need another hero, was almost as big as the movie.
And you know, that's not even my favorite song from the movie. My favorite song is the one that they play over the opening titles, which I think we might play that on our out music today. Shoot Bullets of Fire, you know, One of the Living. That is just an amazing song because the credits are just kind of moving in over that song and it starts so softly. And just like Proud Mary, it builds and then it hits this incredible crescendo. It's a great way to get you into the movie. And then you come out and there's that aerial shot and Bruce Spence is in his little helicopter deal. I mean, it's a great way to start the movie. And you basically start the movie with Tina. It's her voice, if not her face. But Auntie Entity is still, for a lot of people, the best villain of any Mad Max movie.
Love it.
I have a hard time really denying that, because if I think back to, okay, you know, between, you know, the toe cutter and the, you know, Great Humongous, right off to, you know, Last and Fury Road. I mean, you know, these are all kind of psychotic male post-apocalyptic, you know, villains. And Auntie Entity is very different in that world. And Tina gave her this interesting dimension. She is not a typical villain. She's running this town and she has a certain charisma to her, and she's likable when you first see her. You don't sort of root for her to get her head torn off.
This is what she is. She's a villain who is not villainous at
That's
all.
It.
Not villainous at all. Hey man, she says it in her dialogue. I built this out of nothing. Desert. I built this all. You're going to come in here and tell, no, you got, and, but you know what? Raggedy Man.
I'm going to watch that again tonight.
You know, it's just beautiful. She's a villain who's not villainous. She's just trying to run her town, and you men are not going to mess it up for me. You got to earn
this. I'm surprised that she didn't look for more acting roles after that, because she could have had her pick.
But
she did her own thing.
A lot of pressure there. And she got a little typecast. I think same thing happened with Diana Ross. I mean, Diana Ross after Lady Sings the Blues.
Look, for both of them, their first love is singing.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that not everybody wants to be a movie star. Some people are okay being pop stars and rock stars. And, you have to look at maybe some of the actors who have, who moonlight occasionally on the stage. They're okay being actors.
It's a little sad both ways, because we both know them. We've both seen them. Madonna always wanted to be a movie star. Never could. Never made it. Johnny Depp always wanted to be a rock star. And he bought it. He bought it. He paid for it. But you're not a rock star, Johnny. Both, it's a little sad because you are both literally the best at what you do, but you're not satisfied because you want that other thing.
Yeah, it's a good point. I found my little stack of 4Ks from Europe. So I got City of Lost Children on 4K, which makes me very, very happy. And I got Elephant Man, obviously. I got Ron. Akira Kurosawa's Ron. All of these are like Canal Plus. That's why you get them. I got Germinal, which is the Claude Berry adaptation of the Emel Zola. That is never going to get released here in any form whatsoever. Certainly not 4K. But this one makes me very, very happy. And then lastly, I picked up an incredible 4K of Joseph Losey's The Servant. Oh. Dirk Bogarde, Sarah Miles, James Fox. Absolutely tremendous. And that's a creepy film. Didn't want to stay in a place where they chuck balls at your head. So it's a movie I've seen way too many times. All right, let's get first of all, quick, let's just do a little bit of Hollywood chit chat about the first of all, Netflix not sending out any more discs. Got any feelings about that?
Well, personally, to be honest, during that Netflix disc period, I probably only had 20 discs ever. You know, I just wasn't, Blockbuster still existed, of course. So I would find myself wanting to see a movie and I would just go up to Blockbuster and get it. Now, Bridget, my wife, my late wife, she was a Netflix movie. She had a list and she didn't even know what movies were on the list. She just put them on the list and they would come and I would go to the mailbox and there'd be these movies. So I guess I was using the Netflix mailing service, but being a lazy bastard and not actually using it there. So when I heard that it was going away, it literally did not affect me at all. But I do know that there were a lot of people ridiculously nostalgic about getting those discs in the mail.
Well, we got an email from Phil Vater. I hope I'm not mispronouncing his name. Longtime listener. And he said he was asking, you know, about rental options. And he said, I've been meaning to send this note for some time now, but now that Netflix has announced that disc rental will cease, I needed to send my note. He says, I know you've addressed this topic on the podcast, the endangerment of discs being available as time goes on. I also wondering if you see discs going away generally and what the options are to the dilemma. And anyway, here's what I'm requesting: ideas from you regarding alternative, decent disc rental services or how I can get a good handle on access to titles. So I would say I don't see discs going away ever, frankly, because streaming discontinues things and people like to own stuff. There's always going to be a market for them, but first of all, you have no idea how many DVD players are still out there in the world. It's an unbelievable number of DVD players. You have no idea how many people are out there who don't have cable and don't have streaming, who are still watching with rabbit ears, regular broadcast television and not paying for it.
Yeah, me.
I mean, there are. It's real. So there are millions.
You did right about the. And you and I are the exact right age to know this as a fact.
Yeah.
Our vinyl collections.
Yes.
Some people gave up, and what are they doing now? Recollecting their vinyl.
That's right.
And then there are those of us who never gave them up and had the good sense to hold on to them in the first place. And we have these extremely – people want stuff, dude. I have my VHSs, and I have three functional VHS players.
When the internet goes down, you can't watch streaming. But I can still pull out a disc.
Mm-hmm.
And when the internet is throttled, you can't get your full resolution, I can still put a 4K in and watch the best picture there is. So there you go. As for disc rental options, I got some that I sent to Philip, and I'm going to name them right now. There's Gamefly.com, which mostly rents video games, but they also rent movies. So you create a queue and you can do all that. And there's movie only plan. It's about $9 a month. They don't have a ton of movies, but they have movies. So Gamefly.com. There's also Redbox. Redbox is, stuck around and somehow made that business model work. There is a 3D Blu-ray rental at www.store-3d-blu-rayrental.com. Not the easiest URL, but it's worth checking out. Blog.scarecrow.com will take you to the Scarecrow rent by mail system from Scarecrow Video, which is kind of they're Seattle based. It's a rent by mail program. It's a little bit clunky, but they've got a ton of titles, 145,000 titles. So, you should be able to find something there. And then lastly, your library, your local library. Everybody's local library has Blu-rays and DVDs and 4Ks that you can rent. And what's available obviously depends on the librarian and what they're choosing, but they have a, they have a job to do, and their job is to make sure that they stock a lot of great books and music and movies. And
you buy them at libraries, all that stuff. Love it.
So you'll find it at the library. If you have a good library system, you live in a good city, or even, you know, a good county library system, you'll find that stuff. Let's talk about the strike right now. What's your vibe with the strike? Cause I've been trying to keep up. I keep meaning to go down and join some of my friends on the line in front of, the old 20th Century Fox lot, but I haven't gotten down to do it yet. But you know, your vibe.
This strike, I think, will probably become strikes over the course of the next several days. The SAG and the directors have deadlines. I think June the 30th or something like that is at least one of them. And negotiations are already underway there. I'm taking this from people that I'm talking to, like you, who are sort of like on the inside a little bit. That anything would resolve before SAG goes out, I just don't think it's possible. I just don't think it's possible because all of the same things are at issue. And one thing builds on another thing.
You feel like we're going to have writers and actors striking at the same time?
At least there will be some overlap.
It's never happened before.
Never. Because of the way of the order in which these things happen for a whole bunch of reasons. And then of course the directors too. The directors are a little bit different. They do have a contract. There are some things at issue. They're not quite the same. So I don't know how much leverage,
they want some of the same concessions.
If they
give up the data to the directors, they're going to have to give it up to the writers and the actors. And that takes away a big, AI, the issues with AI are relevant, you know, substantially to writers, but also to directors too.
And actors. Sherman and I was just talking about this yesterday. Voices and whatnot, not to mention.
You want to control. I mean, in the age of AI and deep fake, actors are now terrified that they may not get to control their voices and their likenesses forever. I mean, you had that that AI replicating Joe Rogan's voice. That is terrifying.
I've been playing around with myself for a whole bunch of reasons.
For voice print identification.
And the thing of it is, it will only get better. So, for instance, Sherman, made this movie. Our homie Sherman Augustus over on Stranger Things made this movie. Needed to do some ADR. Right. And this is all stuff you get paid for, by the way, as an actor coming back and doing ADR and replacing lines, all that kind of stuff. It's all working income generating stuff and work for you to go and do. But, you know, they hit them up and they said, we're good. And you know why they were good?
Oh,
AI.
No.
Because they had an entire catalog of Sherman. You know, he's in the whole freaking movie. So, you know, and all they do is feed the AI his voice. And the more of it they feed, the better it gets. So when it came time for them to, you know, the ADR, they just told the AI and they got clean passages of Sherman saying 2-3 words, a sentence.
Right. And see, if you do that, you need to pay the actor as if they came in to do it.
To do it. Which is one of the things the actors will be fighting for when their contract comes up. And as writers, you and I are both writers, so this matters to us. I'm technically in the Writers Guild. I haven't paid my Writers Guild dues in over 25 years because, you know, I don't know. But once was in the guild. And all of that. So for us, these scripts that you and I have written over the years and that have gone into the world in one way or another, some of them been made or whatever, that becomes of the great a part of the great AI pool, right?
Yeah.
And all of that AI out there looking at movies that you and I have written, some of them made, some of them, that AI is taking story, is, you know what I mean? And then writing. So we got these buddies in Atlanta and these are guys, you know, who was talking about, you know, hiring a screenwriter to write the script. They have these concepts or whatever. They feed the concepts into the AI and the AI are spitting out scripts for these guys. Now, to my mind, these scripts are terrible.
Yeah, of course they are.
But they'll get better. But they'll still be terrible. But these guys, rather than pay a SAG screenwriter the proper rates, you know, to write a script, what they're doing is paying. I said SAG. I meant WGA, Writers Guild. What they're doing is paying Writers Guild writers to script doctor the scripts. right? So they still get a script doctored by a real writer, a writer skill writer, but they only have to pay a script doctor's fee, much less than the what you would pay a writer to, you know, originally write an original script, right? I'm getting down the weeds now, but you see what
you know, these are all issues. It's going to take a bit to detangle them. How long do you think what's your gut tell you about how long the strike's going to last?
I think top of fall. I think to September is what I think. That's my gut. What are you thinking? What are you hearing?
Well, I mean, I talked to a lot of people who have some insight into it, and they say the sides are so far apart that even if we started to get close today, literally today, if we started to find points of agreement, just in terms of how long it takes to negotiate those points into legal language that then is drafted by attorneys and put into a document, which they then have to vet. Even if we start getting close today, that process cannot be concluded before August. Mm. That just in terms of the logistics of the doing of it, you know, it's not like, I mean, you actually have to put this stuff into the legalese and attorneys have to go over it and people have to vote on it. And that process alone, just in terms of the time that it consumes, cannot be completed before August. So that's why I'm beginning, you know, when people told me, oh yeah, not before September or October, I realize why. And so I'm kind of feeling like end of September, beginning of October looks like probably the right time frame. I don't think they want this to drag on into award season. These companies have too much to lose in terms of relationships and money and the holiday season. If it drags on into award season, now you are putting next year's summer movie slate at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because those movies have to, you know, they're going to, a lot of those movies are shot. But you know, they may need some rewriting if actors are not available for ADR, that kind of stuff. Now you're making it very, very hard for them in the long term. You're putting at risk what may be the first normal movie year for the box office since pre-pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, next year was supposed to be the right year. And Hollywood suspended all of its COVID guidelines like 2 weeks before the strike started. So we're still in this force majeure period, right? Mm-hmm. It hasn't been normal for over 3 years. So everyone is eager for a normal year again, a normal $10 billion box office year with summer movies. And if you drag this out too long, it wipes out next year as well.
Yeah.
It's a whole other write-off. So I do feel like companies that are obsessed with quarterly earnings are not going to want it to let it go past October. They just can't. They can't.
One of the things that the writers are doing now, literally as we speak, is they've started to take the focus and push it toward executives. They're out there now talking about executive compensation. You know, mostly they talk about their compensation, this AI and all this kind of stuff. But now they're drawing the very direct comparison to executive compensations, which I got to tell you, dude, are obscene. And this is why, because I never care about how much money anybody makes. I'm all for making as much money as you can if you earned it. Earned it. I'm looking at all these executives, and I'm talking about across the board now. I don't see anybody who's earned a nickel that they've made, let alone the multi-hundreds of millions of dollars that they've made. If you make me $1 billion, I'll gladly pay you $100 million.
Yeah.
You lost me $8 billion. What the fuck am I going to give you $163 million for?
So the one that really, really stings, and let's be honest, Netflix is where most of the sticking points are. Netflix, and their buyout model, their non-residual model, is the one that everybody has been really bitter about, because nobody knows how successful stuff is on Netflix, and however successful it is long term, nobody gets a piece of it because their rights are all bought out. So that's going to change. All of that is going to change. And Netflix doesn't have a backstop. All the other studios, they're backstopped by multinationals. They put movies into theaters. Amazon sells stuff online. Apple sells computers. All these other companies have other businesses. Netflix does not. Streaming is all they are. They're billions and billions and billions of dollars in debt. They have never turned a profitable quarter, ever. Mm. Their stock price keeps going up based on expectations of future profitability. And based on that, last year, Ted Sarandos and Reed Hastings each took a $50 million bonus. Now, that's $100 million in the pockets of two men who don't make movies, who don't make TV shows, and whose company has never turned a profit. And the writers are struggling to pay their mortgages.
Yeah.
It's awfully, awfully tough for them to justify that. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's very, very tough. So they have to understand that they are the face of this strike.
Yeah.
And people are going to want them to eat some crow.
You can't justify it morally, but nobody gives a shit about morals. But you can't justify it to stockholders. I own some Netflix, right? Not a lot.
Yeah.
I got a little. And so I feel like I can say I'm a little pissy about all of that. So and you'll multiply me by however many stockholders there are there.
Well, real quickly, just a couple of things before we finally get into the DVDs and Blu-rays. VCI Classics has now launched a streaming app. And they did this last December. It is not available on Apple TV yet, but that's going to be coming this year. But it is on Roku. So, keep an eye out for that. VCI Classics is going to jump into the streaming market. It's a crowded market right now. It's getting even more crowded. People don't have money for all these services, but VCI has a great library. I think they'll find a place and some followers. And, we also had some inquiries, notably from, Mario Mendez, longtime listener, wanting to know what happened to our online show. Still working on it. A lot of things in the works. You know, I'm, as everybody knows, I've got this feature thing that we're pushing as well. So we got a lot of balls in the air, but we're going to get them all together at some point.
Thanks for asking, though. Thanks for asking. That means we penetrated a little bit. Appreciate it. Yes.
And then I had a little correction on my recollection, my David Bowie recollection. We came from Al Lai, longtime listener, said, begging your pardon, but must get clarification. You say Bowie was with Iman at the Greystoke screening. Greystoke was released in 1984. and I don't think Bowie met Iman until a blind date in 1990, and they married in 92. So, yes, my recollection, I'm sure, was merging things. He goes on to say he was dating and engaged to a Melissa something, one of Tony Basil's dancers during the 1987 Glass Spider tour. I love Bowie fanatics. They know this stuff.
I love it. Well, she was Melissa, a tall sister with a long neck and amazing legs.
Well, look,
because I can see how you get that.
Bowie was with somebody, and in my mind, it was Iman, because that's just who Bowie was always with.
Yeah,
but
that's who she with. Yeah,
somebody else. Anyway, he goes on to say, don't mess with a Bowie fanatic. Seen him 9 times. I love it. Nine times.
I hope he has. There are two Bowie documentaries now, right? The one from before he passed. Yeah. I gotta look those up. But I'm sure we've talked about them on the show. Those two Bowie documentaries. Gotta have them.
All right. Well, let's jump in. Let's start with the 4K stuff.
Okay.
Let's start with the 4K stuff. First, right off the top, Star Trek Next Generation 4 movie collection, 4K. This is all the Next Generation stuff in one little thick keep case. Star Trek Generation, Star Trek First Contact, Star Trek Insurrection, and Star Trek Nemesis. Picard Riker and the gang and Geordi and Worf and all of them.
That movie gave us Tom Hardy. He didn't give us Tom Hardy, but the young Tom Hardy,
Young Tom Hardy. And, there's some interesting Michael and Denise Okuda text commentary stuff in here. Some featurettes, 4-part featurette on Brent Spiner and Data. And, other little fan service stuff. It's all fine. It's not an amazing collection of extras. But again, you know, you're getting it because you want to watch these movies in 4K. Do they look good? They look really good. But ultimately, how do these movies hold up is my question. And I got some thoughts, but you first.
Well, first of all, none of these movies are great, but you have to be a fan. You have to love it. You have to love Next Gen, the series and all of that kind of stuff. And then it becomes necessary. For me, they're necessary, but they're not necessary in the way, that the first set of original Star Trek films are necessary, particularly say Wrath of Khan. There's no equivalent to Wrath of Khan in this movie. Nemesis comes close.
It does.
One thing I do like about these movies is that they bleed over into the balance of the Star Trek Next Gen stuff, Picard, rather nicely, references and stuff like that, back through First Contact and Insurrection and even Generations. That if you're a Picard fan, the next a generation and Picard fan, I like those little touchstones there. So not a great set of movies in gen. No Wrath of Khan here. But, you know, I'm a fan of all this stuff, dude. So, yeah.
Well, I'll say I like Generations because Shatner's in it, and you get to see Shatner and Picard together, and Shatner's on a horse, and it's a whole dumb thing of mine. I just, anytime Shatner's hamming it up, I do enjoy it. So I like that. First Contact, I'm not a huge fan of. I think it kind of screws up the storytelling. However, I'm a fan of one part of First Contact, and it's a part where they're all crawling through some kind of a tube. And Alfre Woodard is, you know, kind of looking where she's going, and she turns out of the tube. She keeps crawling down this air duct or whatever it is. And then my good friend Dean Heyman Mason from film school, who was employed as an extra on that film, Dean makes the most of his close up right behind her. He turns to hit, he shoots his profile right in the camera. It is a beautiful thing. I still laugh at it to this day. I absolutely love it. Go Dean.
Yeah.
No, that's it. It's just my favorite part of that movie. It's I don't care about the rest of the movie. I just enjoy Dean crawling on Alfre Woodard's heels. Insurrection, I think, is a terrible film. I just think it's absolutely horrible. I can't. It's unwatchable. And then Nemesis, I think, is pretty good. Nemesis is pretty good.
You know, that Tom Hardy is strong in that movie. You know, he registered with me, you know, playing the sort of clone of, or whatever the hell he is, of Jean-Luc over there. And again, all of that is going to be called back to, you know, here 30, 25, 30 years later, which I think is all kind of neato. So yeah, there you go.
We also have The Haunting of Julia on 4K. Gosh, what do you want to say about this? It's not a great film, but it has become kind of a culty film. 1977, a horror film, very much of its, a supernatural horror film, very, very much of its moment, trying to take Mia Farrow and make her replicate the Rosemary's Baby thing. Keir DeLay is, you know, appropriately creepy in it as well, and trying to work a little 2001 stuff out of it. On balance, I don't know if it really holds up that much, but as far, you know, it's also coming on the heels of The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to keep, you know, the whole Omen, Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby thing in play at the late time of 1977, when those movies are going away and Halloween and Friday the 13th and slasher films are kind of coming in. So, I mean, as a transitional film, I think it's got some credibility.
Well, and you look at it, Mia still has that little short haircut that she had been wearing, you know, whatever, however long that would have been, 10 years, 8 years, 8 years before. She's dead sexy in this movie, though. Tom Conti, young Tom Conti in the movie. But it's just weird sort of crossover movie. You're watching this movie and it's a contemporary movie, you know, 1977, but you feel like you're watching a movie that was made 10 years earlier. As you say, when at that time in 77, dude, it's Jason, it's, you know, whoever, you know, running around doing all that kind of stuff. This is kind of like not the thing anymore. Richard Locrane.
We also got a 4K Steelbook, Best Buy exclusive for Crank with Jason Statham. Not a fan of this movie, but it's on 4K. A lot of people are. This movie the whole point of this is that it's a mile a minute movie, real time, intense action, highly stylized. It's a little bit of a gimmick that this is kind of hyper adrenalized action film based on, you know, a guy who's got to save his life and he only has so much time to do it, all this junk. But for people who are into that, then, you know, you run out to Best Buy and grab yourself the Crank Steelbook. M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin. I don't know. Did you see this, and did you think you have any opinion about it?
Well, you look to me, these last few M. Night movies, including this one, have been better than that chunk of work right after his whole, you know,
Sixth Sense. Trying to keep, I agree.
Know, and these are all smaller in scale, and you know they have very centralized, very, you know, old. I think is another one there. So to that extent, I'm like, yeah, you know, these are as effective as any of the so. Once I stopped looking for some big, gigantic M. Night, Sixth Sense-y, the villagey, the blah, blah, blah kind of thing, and just let M. Night make his little movies that are about the little things that they're about, they fit. They're just fine. They work just fine.
Yeah, there's a central dilemma here, which I won't give away, but there's a really interesting existential dilemma, which is something that people always bring up in conversation. You know, it's one of those horrible what-ifs. And so he's taking that horrible what if that is usually hypothetical and trying to frame it in a very realistic sense, like it could really, what if it really happened? And to that degree, I think there's some interesting stuff in here. I like the cast. I don't think the movie's great. Dave Bautista, I just think, is one of the most underrated actors. Talking about people who go from being one thing to another, from being an athlete to an actor, you know, that Jim Brown trajectory. Dave Bautista, there's another one.
Yeah, he can play that drama. He can play that. He can play empathy and vulnerability, despite the size and all that kind of stuff. You know, I like M. Night at this scale better than at the scale of, you know, whatever big gigantic crap he's doing.
I agree. We also have Deep Impact. There were a couple of these at the time. I forget what the other one was
Armageddon.
Armageddon was the other one. Forgot about it. Anyway, I thought Mimi Leader did a much better job with this. She never really went on to have the big Hollywood action career that she deserved. She was coming out of TV doing a lot of stuff like China Beach.
And she created a lot of that style, you know, Mimi.
Yeah.
We forget ER. She was the one that said, let's get these cameras moving, man. And let's do these long runs of dialogue. She took Clooney over to the, what was that movie they did together? The Peacemaker.
That's right. Peacemaker, great chase scene. My gosh, the car chase in that is tremendous. That
long thing with Clint, it was great. Yeah. And Mimi had and this.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really good stuff in this. Morgan Freeman, Tia Leone, Elijah Wood, Vanessa Redgrave, Blair Underwood, you know, Maximilian Schell even shows up. No, there's a lot of great stuff in this movie. I think it's still a little bit on the Hollywood obnoxious side, a little overblown with the CG and whatnot, but you know what? Mimi's a really good director, and gosh, I wish she would come out of her TV moment again and get back to features, but maybe she doesn't want it.
Hey, well, look, you could stay at home with TV. There was this, and it was Armageddon. So this, Mimi, this is Bruce Joel Rubin, blah, blah, blah. And Armageddon over there is Mike Bay and, you know, whoever. JJ, I think JJ was one of the writers on Armageddon, I think. JJ, maybe Tony Gilroy. And you were either both 98, so you were either an Armageddon person or you were a Deep Impact person.
That's right, that's true. That's true.
You know, and I remember that we would have these little, you know, battles. Deep Impact was a more serious movie, if you can say, you know, a movie about it's a serious movie. And then
was just cheese.
Yeah, you know. And then they did the same thing with Movies to Mars a couple of years later.
That's right.
It was, so I'm sure we'll talk about those soon.
Little superhero action on the DC side. Justice League and RWBY, Superheroes and Huntsmen, Part 1. This is utterly silly, the crossover between Justice League and RWBY. It's all in the service of branding. So they have a little bit of fun with this very strange animated, quasi-anime fusion concept in this DC animated movie. And it's a cliffhanger, so there's more coming. I couldn't get into it, but I guess, you know, for the core fan base, they'll absolutely go nuts. On 4K, it is very, very impressive. I'll say that. They've really turned it up. When they do 4K on the DC animated stuff, they really, really bring out all the animation. It's just super, super crisp. The contrast is great. The blacks are really dark and rich. And, it does kind of give it a better comic sheen.
A lot of great young voices too. And one of the things I like about this series is that you hear all these great voices, and they're young voices because your characters are sort of young, and they're not movie stars. They're voice actors. Really kind of like when we were growing up, you know, and all those great voice actors were out there doing stuff. Yeah. Very often when you move a notch up to the stuff that's going to be theatrically released, or it's, you know, whatever, you start getting all these movie star voices, taking over these roles. But these folks, these are great voice actors, and I love what they do.
So let's talk about Shazam, Fury of the Gods, for a second, because one of the bright spots for DC in the pre-David Zaslav, pre-Discovery merger era was that first Shazam movie. The Snyderverse was kind of falling on its face. They were messing that up very badly. No fault of Snyder's. We have to give him credit. You know, that was just the Joss Whedon and all that stuff. Wonder Woman did well, but the rest kind of flopped, and Shazam came out and it was really fun and it did well. And it was a surprising success. And I think everybody had really high hopes that this one, despite Black Adam being a big stinker, I think everybody kind of felt like, no, but people run out. And you know what? They didn't. Mm-mm. And it kind of flopped. Was it the Black Adam impact on this? Did that just kind of steal some of the thunder, so to speak? or was this movie just not good enough? Or are people sick of this? I don't know.
Yeah, you get a little bit of all of it, but at the top of it, these movies aren't good. Black Adam at the top of it wasn't good. It was not a good movie. And at the top of it, this is not a particularly good movie. You know, the one before that, so you pack all of these quote unquote superheroes. This is another one that's just packed full of superheroes. Into a movie, and you wrap them in a whole bunch of special effects and have them doing whatever special effects stuff that they're doing, and whatever, almost arbitrary. Sometimes these storylines are almost arbitrary. Because what we're really doing is servicing these characters, the movie stars playing these characters and the crap that they have to do. So audiences aren't dumb. We can see all of that. And by the way, you and I were entertained in Superman, original Superman, Chris Reeve, 1976, whenever the heck it was, right there.
Yeah.
The only superhero in that movie was Superman. Lex Luthor wasn't even a superhero. Ned Beatty was out of just one movie, one superhero in the whole movie, you know, and we loved it. So why the notion is you got to have 10,000 superheroes and supervillains. Superman was the only dude that could fly in the movie.
Only one we needed.
And he was fine.
So I'm going to make a real interesting pivot here. You know, Superman and Lex Luthor, at least in the comics, were childhood friends turned nemeses. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the same story of Adonis Creed and Damian that is depicted in Creed 3. So let's pivot from Superman to Creed 3. And it's very Superman and Lex Luthor-esque storyline, because now we got Michael B. Jordan taking over as director and still a star, taking, you know, the reins from Ryan Coogler. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Majors showing up like, you know, with a body that shames even Michael B. Jordan's. Did we need this movie? You and I have had this conversation. So did we need Creed 3?
Is it a solid movie that definitely establishes itself as legit in the long Rocky canon, Creed 3, but you know, we're really talking about something that goes way, way back here. And there has to be touchstones all the way through, which there are. This movie continues, and that's one of the things I like the most about it. It has a deep recognition of the entire legacy, of what's going on. This is what I like about this movie, and I like this movie. You know, and of course, this movie came out before all the shenanigans with what's his name and all that kind of stuff. So when I watched this movie, I kind of got it clean and pure. What I like about this movie is that it's not about boxing at all.
Yeah.
Despite all the fights, there's a whole bunch of fights in this movie. But this movie has nothing to do with boxing and nothing to do with fights. This is a brotherly love story. This is about a man being deeply, deeply hurt.
Yeah.
This dude hurt him emotionally. This is about emotional hurt. It's going to manifest itself and play itself out in a whole bunch of fighting in this ring. But and this is about guilt. He's like, oh my God, I let my boy down. I let him down. I did. And he's and I, you know what I always say about sports movies. When you watch a sports movie and the team that you're rooting for or the person that you're supposed to root for loses and you don't care. That movie was not about the sports. You know, Rocky loses that first fight in that first movie. You don't care. Matter of fact, it's a better movie because he loses. And this movie is the same kind of thing. You don't care who's going to win. What you want are for these guys to work it out. And the whole chunk of this movie that's about brothers working it out. That all that stuff in the barbershop, you know, all that stuff with these guys, you know, I'm like, these guys don't, I keep wanting to say, can't you see you're in love? That's what I keep wanting to say to these guys. Cut it out, you know, work it out, boys, work it out. And they do. So that's what I think about this movie. It's not about
Michael B. Jordan can direct. That's the other big revelation here. And, you know, I would like to see what he does when he's not putting himself in the movie. I think give Michael B. Jordan a job with where he can just be behind the camera the whole time. I think he's definitely earned that, too. Let's pivot back to Superman, because also we now have the 5-film Superman collection, 1978 to 87 on 4K. With Blu-ray and digital code as well. So you can movies anywhere, this thing, to your heart's content. And I intend to. Here's what's included. Superman movie, which Tim was just praising, from 1978. Superman 2 from 1980, which I think we all remember was supposed to be the film of the summer. And then Raiders came out like a week or two later and blew it out of the water. The Superman 2 Richard Donner cut, which, yes, is superior. Superman 3, the hell were they thinking?
And Richard, then finally, Richard Pryor got $1 million. that I know for sure. But even he was disappointed in that they really only wanted him to play it for the comedy. And because Richard Pryor was a very good dramatic actor. Richard Pryor, some kind of hero with that Vietnam movie he made. And a few other movies.
Was it Straight Time?
Straight Time.
Paul Schrader. Yeah.
Great role in Lady Sings the Rules. Richard was a very good dramatic actor. And he knew it wasn't Shakespeare, but he thought that they would give him something to do. But they really, literally, there was no script. They would just have him vamp. But he took $1 million. So what the hell?
Yeah. Well, and then Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, which nearly killed superhero movies entirely. That just was a mess, a complete and total mess. But nonetheless, it is Christopher Reeve is remembered very fondly for this part. These are the movies he made. This is every cut of every movie that he made on 4K, and loads of special features. Can't even get into. They have done really a beautiful job. Warner Brothers always does beautiful job restoring it. The colors just sparkle. The sound is beautiful. The John Williams music in the first film has never sounded more beautiful. It really, really, really just sings. So, you know, Superman fans, go for it. Grab that sucker and enjoy it. We also have Flashdance on 4K, finally.
Oh, my
gosh. 40th anniversary. It's been 40 years since Flashdance. Tim, what a feeling.
Man, look, that movie, I just loved it. We went to see that movie in 83. Before we came to LA, so you know we were still not part of the Hollywood community. So for us, it was just this movie, and it was Adrian Lane and of course Jennifer Beale. It was just this wonderful, wonderful movie. And one of the things I think it does is it proves that before he went bananas, Joe Eisenhower could actually write.
Yeah,
he was a pretty good writer.
Here's what's funny, and this is kind of my Top Gun trajectory, because I hated the original Top Gun. I worked at the theater at the time. I was there. I heard that damn thing. I saw that damn thing every day, over and over and over and over. I just thought, what a stupid movie. Why are these people cheering? And I loved it last summer. I loved it. Flashdance, when I first saw it, I just thought, this is the dumbest movie I've ever seen. I love this movie today. It's pure nostalgia. This came out when I was working at the theaters, right? And I look back and I don't think we realized how good we had it. First of all, let me just say, on 4K, unbelievable. The famous dance bit with the water and the silhouette and the whole thing, which is the cover, by the way, of the 4K. That has never looked so crisp. If you're watching that on a proper set, a TV set that really will just bring out all the richness of 4K, you won't believe it. Turn the lights out. It'll just blow your mind. But I'll say this. I look back on that era of Paramount movies. Mm. And this kind of represents it. You had Sherry Lansing and Stanley mm-hmm. Jaffe and mm-hmm. Bruckheimer and Simpson and Eisner and Katzenberg, all of these people at the same time at the same studio mm-hmm. who would go on to make other studios very, very wealthy when they finally broke up. But that was an unbelievable core of people, an incredible core of people.
These were all people who were willing at that period, to let movies abandon any sense of reality at all. There was nothing real about this movie at all. No. Jennifer Beale was a welder at this place that was backlit in neon all the time, day or night.
It's such a preposterous idea. Jennifer Beale is a welder. Just stop.
But that off the shoulder sweatshirt thing that became an actual clothing thing. This was from this movie, and it penetrated the whole society.
Every girl in Southern California started wearing that, and you know what? God bless them for it.
Thank you. Thank you. And kids breakdancing on those cardboard boxes, right? Which is a thing, and I'm sure that it's in the on the special features on that 4K.
It's all on there. It's a ton of stuff on there.
He'll talk about how they were out and they saw these kids. And they shot him. And that goes in the movie. And the next thing you know, kids all over America are spinning on cardboard boxes on their heads because of that moment in this movie. So, you know, anyway, it's one of those moments.
I forgot to mention this earlier. There's also another DC animated 4K. It's All-Star Superman, which is okay. It's a Lex Luthor thing. Superman's dying and Luthor's going to, you know, rule the universe. And then, you know, of course, it all resolves perfectly fine. This is not great. But I guess for Superman completists, you can probably suck it up. Ed Asner,
and
voice talent here is really the only thing that I found sort of entertaining and amusing.
This is one of the ones, the opposite of what I was talking about before. Because you're Ed Asner, but you got Anthony LaPaglia, you got Christina Hendricks, you got Linda Cardellini, you got all these movie stars, you know, Francis Conroy, you know, I mean, all these movie stars. And I don't know, I find that ridiculously distracting. Rather than just voice actors just knocking it out, I don't know, just whatever, it's a bug up my ass.
And as part of the Warner Brothers 100th anniversary celebration, and Disney is also having a 100th celebration, although remember, Disney, it's not the 100th anniversary of the studio. It is the 100th anniversary of the creation of Mickey Mouse, which is what they trace their lineage to. But for Warner Brothers, this is legitimately, you know, 1923 to 2023. That is a legit 100th anniversary celebration. And they're releasing a lot of old classics onto 4K. I got three right here. Cool Hand Luke, The Maltese Falcon, and Rebel Without a Cause. All three I would recommend. They all come with the Movies Anywhere code. They all come with a reasonable amount of special features. Commentary on Rebel Without a Cause is particularly good. It's by Douglas Rathgeb, who wrote The Making of Rebel Without a Cause, and it's got some, you know, Blu-ray. The Blu-ray also has some behind-the-scenes things and a lovely, lovely memoir involving Dennis Hopper. The Maltese Falcon has a ton of stuff, most of which we've already seen before, including commentary by Bogart biographer Eric Lax. And then there are a few things on Cool Hand Luke, commentary by Eric Lax as well, who also has written a Newman biography. But on balance, I think all three of these films represent exactly the kind of film that we associate with Warner Brothers. And that's the point I wanted to make and see if you agree. Because, Maltese Falcon, it's that tough guy thing that they started with. But all the way straight up to the present day with Clint Eastwood, who's been a part of Warner Brothers history for 50 years now. Warner Brothers is, let's admit it, it is a studio that has a very male profile. Mm-hmm. And they were not a studio that made necessarily women's pictures. When they did, it was Bette Davis. And Bette Davis is not exactly anybody's mm-hmm. idea of, you know, a quintessential woman. It wasn't like these melodramas. That mm-hmm. was for Columbia and some other studios.
Warner Brothers was film noir, if you think Warner Brothers.
That is film noir.
Yeah.
And Cool Hand Luke, Paul Newman in his day, and James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause, they sort of represent exactly what Warner Brothers has always been, which is a studio that explores the many facets of conflicted masculinity. And so I think this is an interesting trio of films to release, all of these from, you know, different eras, but all kind of living in the same space. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I agree completely. Complicated films with complicated leads, not exactly anti-heroes per se, you know, Cool Hand.
Yeah.
And Luke and all of that kind of stuff, but films with leading male characters who were difficult to like, and not always right, and I kind of like that about both of these films. And you're right, they're just absolutely gorgeous. Yeah.
Let's get into some TV stuff right now. Mm. Got a whole bunch of TV here. The two that I want to just mention right off the top of the bat, complete series collection on Blu-ray for Cheers, which has been long, long awaited. And I'm thrilled that it's finally here. And a lovely Mill Creek complete series Blu-ray set for Dawson's Creek, which weirdly enough is like this really old series now. Like James Vanderbeek is now in the news looking like a really old guy and being really pissy about the possibility of not having any presidential debates. And look, I saw that clip on social media and I thought, weren't you just a kid like 5 minutes ago in Dawson's Creek? It's a very strange thing.
Oh, but, all these kids. You know what's interesting about Dawson's Creek is that all those kids made it. You know, they're all they're all very successful actors, right out there in the world doing what they do. And then, you know, me a little bit. Katie married Tom Cruise for a second there, but you know, got herself together. But all of these kids made it, and they were kids when I encountered them. I watched Dawson's Creek, the entire series. I've seen every one of those. I was a big fan. But they all made it.
Talk about Dawson's Creek for a second. What was it about that show? Because Michelle Williams, if I was going to pick somebody to come out of that show with a head of steam and become a super movie star, I would have picked Katie Holmes. And I would not have said Michelle Williams will become one of our great actresses.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
She has. It's really interesting.
Well, you know, while Katie's still, you know, a perfect. So that show at the time, and I would have been, I think I was in 1998. I would have been about. I was in my middle 30s or something like that. So watching that show, all of those kids were younger than me. It did a couple of things that I thought was really great. Excellent writing about actual storylines that struck me as real. Really great dramatic professional story making and filmmaking. It had a cinematic sort of dynamic, which was interesting because Dawson was like this kid who was hooked on Steven Spielberg movies. You know, I'm not going to take people into the entire thing, but that was the thing. So there were all these sort of references. This is Kevin Williamson. And then all of these kids, Michelle and Joshua and Katie and James in particular, just could act their asses off. These were not the kids of the sitcoms and or quote unquote dramatic shows that you and I grew up watching. The Partridge Family, the Brady Bunch, you know, with these sort of terrible scripts and terrible acting and terrible filmmaking of shows that we still love to this very day. No, this was like, wow, this is like real dramatic television, that happens to be about these teenagers.
And a lot of good stuff on there is interviews and commentaries and some really, really wonderful stuff. It is a more landmark seminal show than I think a lot of people want to give
it. The music. I forgot to mention the music. Every one of those shows had contemporary music that of course broke some contemporary artists of the day. Every single one of that music, them and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, they were all doing it.
And Cheers, I just can't say enough about this. You know, this show still has it cast a long shadow, not just because it's one of the great all-time sitcoms, but Cheers, let's remember, it didn't just spawn Frasier. There's a new Frasier series.
Mm-hmm.
So Cheers still has a spinoff on the air that's starting again. And I think that may be the longest time one character has been on television ever. I might be wrong, but Frasier, you know, played by Kelsey Grammer, is just he's not going away. What a great show this was. Loved Kirstie Alley, the late Kirstie Alley, who stepped into a very awkward situation here. A show that was literally defined in its first several seasons by the Sam and Diane on again, off again romance of opposites. I mean, it was built around that relationship. And when Shelley Long left, a lot of people said the show's over. You can't, that's the central tension of the show. You cannot, all those great supporting characters, you can't do it. You can replace Coach with Woody, but you can't replace Diane. And son of a gun, they brought in Kirstie Alley, and it was a whole new show. And then they brought in Frasier and Lilith, and they found a way to use that bar to manufacture more than just that original premise. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a credit to the writers and the directors and just all the magic that they wrought on this incredible show.
Yeah, man. James Burrows, Glennon, Les Charles over there. Sam and Diane became a phrase that you could use to reference a sort of their real Sam and Diane.
I used it in reviews where I said, I can't even remember what movie I was reviewing, but I said, boy, the movie depicts this couple as being more on again, off again than, well, Sam and Diane. I don't even remember what the movie was, but I remember I made that reference.
And of all the people, look, again, lots of great talent, it came from and out of and all that. But if you had told me, the one who's going to actually go on to become a legit Hollywood movie star and will remain so for the next 30 years is going to be Woody. the goofy bartender who replaced
Michelle Nicholas Williams. Michelle Williams.
I'm like, get out of here. That guy's going to become a big movie. But he just walked right into becoming a major legit Hollywood movie star. Leading man, villain, capable character actor. And who would have thunk? Who would have thunk?
Couple of complete series here from very different eras. We've got the complete series of Go On with Matthew Perry. It's a complete series because it just didn't last very long. It's 22 episodes, but it's an okay show. I think it was a little bit of a misfire, but it's a good thing to watch for Matthew Perry fans. He's good in it. The rest of the show just isn't very good. And the original 1957 television series Blondie, from Classic Flicks, FLIX, they've just released the two-disc set with 26 episodes of this very strange live-action adaptation of the comic strip, which in hindsight, have you ever seen this? Ever seen any of these? Because I hadn't seen these ever. I think you, maybe it was on, because you're a little older than I am, so this may have still been there for you, but it wasn't there for me.
Oh, yeah. And look, I gotta be square with you. Blondie, who played Blondie? What was her name?
Pamela Britton.
That played Blondie.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, gorgeous with the dude. I had a thing for that chick because I'm like if that's the one.
Penny Singleton.
Yeah, Blondie. Yeah. That was a little bit later one. But were they both Arthur Lake as Dagwood?
I'm definitely thinking of Penny Singleton here.
Yes, they changed Blondie's, but Penny Singleton Blondie. Oh my God, she was as gorgeous and had a better body than Marilyn Monroe. With baby dumpling running around those. Yeah, those were on all the time when I was a kid. I used to watch them all the time. Yeah,
it's such a peculiar. I mean, if you don't know the comic strip, you kind of miss a lot of the jokes because it really is riffing on it. Hal Roach Studios tried to legitimize themselves for television or the early stage television with this. And I mean, it's a really fascinating artifact. I don't know that it dates terribly well, but it's got a lot. If you know the comic strip, there's a lot of really funny stuff in it. Blondie is still a thing today, I guess, right? It's still in like 2000 newspapers is what the press stuff was telling me.
Well, even in the cartoons. Look, that stuff, look it up. You'll see what I mean. It's very interesting the way that stuff was sort of shaped.
And we got some individual season stuff here on Blu-ray. Got South Park in its 25th season, still killing it. I don't know how those guys keep doing it. I would be exhausted. It's just the turnaround there. Mark used to talk about how they turn those an episode around in like a week and a half. Wow. I mean, I don't know how you even do that with an animated show, but that's how they stay on the news cycle. We got the third season of His Dark Materials from HBO, which I never really got into, but I know a lot of people love this.
I watched that. Yeah.
Not heavy on the extras, but that is definitely out there on Blu-ray. Primal, the complete second season. You know, in totally insane animation, a little bit anime inflected, but I kind of get it. I mean, it's it could skew completely young, but it doesn't. It doesn't really. It still skews a little bit, you know, grown up, and it's good animation. It's really good animation. It's won a bunch of Emmys, and so check that out. It's better than, it's like Masters of the Universe for adults. Yeah. Maybe a better way of putting it. NCIS Hawaii season one. Let's talk about this for just a second. NCIS is doing what all the other acronym shows have done, which is just venture from city to city, whether it's CSI or Law and Order or, you know, what's the other one?
Oh my God. Vegas. Are they in Vegas? No.
Yeah. Anyway. Anyway, NCIS finally says, you know what? Let's go steal some thunder from Magnum and Hawaii 5-0. Does it work? I don't know. I guess it's a beautiful cast. It's very, you know, very CW looking cast, but, it makes sense. You know, you have Pearl Harbor as a backdrop, and it's never really been a backdrop for a TV show, outside of World War II. So, you know, beautiful people. They get to take their clothes off occasionally and do the Hawaii thing. Love the Hawaii setting.
Look, bro, that's a mess of pretty cops. that's a whole lot of pretty cops in one place. So I'm not sure, but hey, roll with it. Magnum, okay, fine. You know, because that's what we're doing. But I'm like, really, seriously? Now, and the other thing is, the original Hawaii 5-0, you know, the one that you and I grew up with. What I liked about that show is I bought all of those cops. Every single one of them. Bought them all.
Every one of them. Every one of them.
I don't know. Whatever. Yeah. This is a lot of pretty cops, but whatever.
Walker made it to season two. I always thought it was very bizarre that they wanted to resurrect Walker without Chuck Norris, because the whole point of the show was that Chuck came with all this real cheesy baggage, and it was more about Chuck Norris than some guy named Walker. So you replace Chuck, what's the point? But they're into a season two. I guess somebody watches this show. I don't really get it. Jared Podolecki or whatever his name is. He's fine. Pretty face. But it still feels like, you know, Magnum PI in a cowboy hat.
It's a family drama. Walker, Texas Ranger, you know, the one that we watched at the end of the day. Yeah. Like, it was a cop, you know, thing. There'd be some bad guy doing something, and him and Travis Trickle, whatever his name is, is hit with the. And I always liked that the brother wore the white hat and Walker wore the black hat. I'm like, that's cool. And they would roll out and they would catch the bad guy. And this is a family drama, and there's all kinds of stuff that's going on at the house and at the ranch and stuff with the dad, the mom, and I'm like, I don't think I ever met Walker's mom in that other show. I mean, I'm pretty sure his mom was never in an episode of that show, but you know, she's in this show.
Yeah. And then Yellowstone season five, which has a very, very judicious sticker on the packaging that says includes the first eight episodes of season five. The whole Yellowstone thing, I have been trying to sort of get into it from the beginning. And all of our friends who love the show, they're ridiculing me for not, you know, buying the whole thing. I'm like, but it's Dynasty on the Prairie. They're like, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So. Fair enough.
But there you go again. You and I come from the world of Dallas, the original Dallas and Dallas. Dynasty, dude, Flamingo Road. I mean, the originals, you know, not CW stuff.
Falcon Crest.
Falcon Crest. I'm like, you guys are kidding. You're kidding me? Dude, we have JR, the original JR. This is all funny to me. But, you know, I will say that about this show, everybody wears a black hat in this show. Everybody. I'm like, seriously, everybody? I'm like, okay. Yeah. They're laying it right there out there for you. Everybody wears a black hat.
Yeah. And then lastly, Star Trek Lower Decks season 3. You know, the other Star Trek animated show is like a sitcom and whatnot. I mean, you got to tell me what people see in this. I know a lot of people love this. Our friend Luke Thompson loves this. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. What's the point of this?
I don't know. All the guys with red shirts. Look, it's for the same crowd, because I don't really watch this so much, other than just go familiarize myself. Lower Decks, indeed. That are still watching and still love that South Park that we just talked about a second ago. After 25 years. Now, look, I appreciated me some good South Park for, I don't know, a decade or so, 12 years and whatever. But after a while there, I still got people who watched 25 years worth of South Park, have not missed any of it. I can't do this. There's some things I can let go. And this was one I was able to let go.
We do film week. So we have to cram, you know, like, I mean, I don't know what you're, I know a little bit how you handle the film week roster. I always tell myself, oh, I've got 2 weeks to, you know, kind of ease myself in. And then I will find myself on a Friday night before we have to tape the following Thursday, literally 6 nights. And I say, I guess if I watch one or two movies a night, I'll make it. And then Sunday night rolls around and I'm like, crap, I've got 3 days to watch like 9 movies. So I wind up basically watching movies from about 8 p.m. until 2 in the morning every single night for like 3 or 4 straight nights. That's how I do it. And it's not healthy.
No, it's a thing, and that happens to me a lot. Sometimes, though, I will try to get out in front of the game, you know, and particularly if we get the list a little bit, and you can go, you know, what's going to be, and you get out in front of the game, and you reach out, and you get a few of these things, and a good 2 weeks ahead of time, I will have watched 3, 4, maybe even 5 of the films.
You're so much less procrastinating than I am.
This is why that's bad, because by the time we get to show day, I can't remember.
On this week's show, literally, there was something I watched on Monday, and by Thursday, I was sitting there staring at the title, trying my best to remember what it was about.
It might be better just to put them all together real nice and neat, you know.
Peek behind the curtain. Yeah. I want to mention a couple of steelbooks real quickly. There's also a Best Buy exclusive of House of 1,000 Corpses, the 20th anniversary edition of the Rob Zombie film, which is maybe the only decent thing he's ever directed. Can you believe it's been 20 years since that movie?
Oh, that is just I did the junket for that movie, the whole damn thing. No, I cannot believe that. That's nuts. Sid Haig, Karen Black, you know,
just nutty. And we also have Michael Mann's Miami Vice in a new unrated director's edition on Blu-ray from Mill Creek, a nice steel book. Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx. We hope Jamie Foxx is recovering well from his recent health scare. Seems to be. He's back on social media, so we're sending him all of our best.
Hey, well, he's a community guy for you. Celebrity for us, but for you, he's the guy in the community.
Oh yeah, yeah. No. His daughter is about 4 years older than mine. So we were all at the elementary school together for a couple of years. And he even guest assistant coached my daughter's basketball team at one point. Tremendous guy, just a really awesome guy. And Colin Farrell, who I adore, I've never met, but you know, he's now an Oscar nominee. And so it's a little weird watching these guys in Miami Vice play these parts that were originated by two other guys on TV. But the movies, it's very different from the TV show. Michael Mann wanted to revisit it and reinvent it, and I think he did it reasonably well given all the constraints at the time. Also, we have a couple of animated things on Blu-ray to make quick mention of. Looney Tunes Collector's Choice Volume 1, part of the Warner Archive Collection. They're putting out some of these Looney Tunes that were previously on DVD, and now they're out. They're going to be doing a series of them, it seems, making the Looney Tunes Collector's Choice series. So a lot of these are out now on Blu-ray. Some of these are really, really quite memorable. Stooge for a Mouse is a really, really a great classic. Doggone Cats is a classic. What's Bruin' is very memorable. And one of my favorites is the one right at the top, Beanstalk Bunny. I absolutely adore Beanstalk Bunny. So some great Looney Tunes in that first volume. And then a really interesting thing here, Max Fleischer's Superman, 17 theatrical shorts from 1941 to 43 from DC, part of the 100th anniversary celebration, including a new featurette that's all about Fleischer's Superman, the animation. A little bit of a controversy with this, that they restored this without grain. They did a restoration of this and a digital version of it that is... it's interesting because normally we'd object to that. If they do it with something like the Maltese Falcon, you want the grain, you want to feel the film. The argument here is that if we strip the grain out, we're more faithful to the artwork, and that you want to replicate these animated efforts, more closely approximate the Fleischer artwork than the filmic quality of projecting that artwork on an old 1930s, 40s era movie screen. I'm not sure I totally buy it. I kind of wish they had given us both, but at the same time, you've never seen the Fleischer artwork look so good and so pristine. So I got to give it some props for that.
The notion being that the artwork, which would have, of course, not had any grain in it at all, had grain added to it by the transfer process way back then. So the thing that we were watching was not the intended thing. It was a necessary artifact of the process.
Precisely.
But if the process had been better, then the image would have approximated this, not that. At the time,
precisely. And as long as we're talking about Warner, let me roll through here. We have because we've been offline for a few weeks, so a lot of Warner Archive Collection titles have come out. Wonderful old classic Warner Brothers movies, all of them worth mentioning. I'm going to go through these as quickly as I can and highlight some of the ones that are really, really worth checking out. There's Clash by Night, which is really quite wonderful in hindsight, a forgotten Marilyn Monroe performance along with Barbara Stanwyck and Robert Ryan, Paul Douglas, really kind of a good, one of the better Hollywood efforts from Fritz Lang. Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Based on the Clifford Odets play. It's a good Fritz Lang film that everybody kind of forgets about a little bit. Ricardo Montalban has never been better. Young Ricardo Montalban looking unbelievable in Border Incident, which is really quite, along with George Murphy, kind of a surprising movie for its era when you look at it through a current day prism. Anthony Mann directed this. It's dealing with conflict at the Mexican-American border, and given what's happening today, you look at this and you kind of go, man, this is kind of a, if it's not a movie ahead of its time, it certainly reflects that the times haven't changed. So that is well worth watching, but Ricardo Montalban is just amazing. James Cagney in A Lion Is in the Streets, one of his great powerhouse performances. For a guy that short to look this big on screen is just unbelievable. Raoul Walsh directed this. Pretty great movie.
Even on that poster, the great Barbara Hale would go on the Perry Mason. Even on that poster, he looks gigantic.
It's a powerhouse performance. It really is. Storm Warning is also a pretty great movie. One of those great dramatic parts by Ginger Rogers. I heard some really interesting Ginger Rogers stories over the weekend. I'll tell you after the show. it's stuff I shouldn't be sharing on the show, but really some really interesting stuff. Anyway, this is one of those movies that, she made when she would go off and say, hey, I'm not just a dancer. She's in this with
it's a heavy movie, man.
Some character actor named Ronald Reagan I've never heard of. Doris Day. They're all really good in this.
This is a movie about the Klan.
It's a tough movie.
This chick goes down and her sister's married to this guy in the Klan. It's a murder and a whole thing, dude. This was heavy duty stuff to be talking about in 1950, and it's a noir. It's a crime movie, but
with an almost entirely white cast.
It's
a little weird to have a Klan movie in which there are no actual black people. But nonetheless, I'm grateful for it. It was a risk at the time. This is when we're talking about the films that Warner Brothers made. What we're talking about earlier, this is that toughness that is so identified with the brand. It's that precisely. A movie called Safe in Hell, which is a pre-code kind of semi-noir. Mm-hmm. It's a little rough and a little raw as pre-code films were, but stylistically as well. 1931, you know, you can tell that there's, you know, they're getting the sound and the picture working for this new technology. But, you know, it was originally made First National Vitaphone picture, now in the Warner Brothers library. And it's a good little gritty, you know, crime film directed by William Wellman. And, you know, it's a nice thing to add to the library.
Well, again, that's content that would be even rough today. You know, the hookers and prostitutes and rape all that pre-code stuff. And in 31, and very good, very, very raw.
William Powell and Kay Francis in One Way Passage. William Powell is just always absolutely delightful, and this is just a classic William Powell quasi thin man performance. And while we're checking out, it has a couple of vintage Lux Radio Theater broadcasts on it. It just gives it a little bit of more of that period sheen, if you love William Powell. Mm. And then lastly, this is the one that I really, really love, another Raoul Walsh film, Strawberry Blonde with James Cagney and Olivia de Havilland and some young punk named Rita Hayworth in a sporting part. This is a terrific film. This is really an awful lot of fun, and it's all that stuff that you associate with classic Hollywood movies. It's funny, it's romantic, it's, you know, it's just got a wonderful, wonderful script that's very, very clever, and it's got some great kind of farcical little twists in it. Rita Hayworth, is not a star in this movie. It's a supporting part, but you look at her and you just go, "Holy cow, you're amazing! You're literally showing up." Olivia de Havilland and James Cagney. Like, now you see how stardom is born. You show up on that movie with some big stars and you steal those scenes from them, and you just, you tip your hat and you go, you knock it out of the park, girl.
A lot of fun faces pop up in this movie. George Reeves going to be Superman. George Tobias, who was the Bewitched. He played the husband across the street with her. And just all kinds of Herbert. I guess a lot of great faces. And I always love seeing them pop up in these movies. Where you just weren't thinking about them at the time, but now you see them, you're like, oh look, it's Alan Hale. That's just Skipper from Gilligan's Island. He's in this movie. All kinds of neat stuff.
Marlena Dietrich, Arthur Kennedy, and Mel Ferrer in Rancho Notorious, another Fritz Lang film, more famous Fritz Lang film, really very, very good. Susan Hayward in the wonderful I'll Cry Tomorrow. Susan Hayward, kind of a little bit forgotten today, but delivered so many really, really great performances. This was an MGM film originally. Directed by Daniel Mann, the other man, not related to Anthony Mann. Susan Hayward, you know, just a terrific melodramatic actress at the time. Greta Garbo, Lionel Barrymore, and Robert Taylor in Camille. I mean, you know, it's Greta Garbo and Camille. I'm sorry. That doesn't need to be even given any further recommendation. It's just right there. And it also includes the 1921 silent version with Rudolph Valentino and Alla Nazimova. And Alla Nazimova, totally forgotten today. But it's nice you get both versions of Camille and, one directed by George Cukor. And, you know, that's the one that we all remember, the Greta Garbo film. Got to have that if you're a Garbo fan. Joan Crawford in Flamingo Road. Mm. We're just talking about the Flamingo Road TV series with why am I drawing a blank now? Morgan Fairchild. Yeah. So, which is very loosely adapted from this, but it's still kind of cool if you know the TV series with Morgan Fairchild and you watch this, you go, oh, I see the DNA. That's pretty cool. They kind of did I get it. Joan Crawford is great. Michael Curtiz directed this one. Mm-hmm. Just a few more here. Lucy and Desi in The Long, Long Trailer, which was made fun of at the time. Huh?
Just watched that the other day on like TCM, one of the places where it runs all the time. It was gorgeous.
Looking, right? It's like the most amazingly rich Technicolor. It's almost like they felt like, you know what? Everyone's been watching these people on TV in black and white for so long. Let's make up for lost time and just add, like, quintuple the color in this movie. Mm. it's really kind of amazing. Yeah, they really overdid the color, but what a fun slapsticky movie.
Vincent Minnelli at his best. Really.
Yeah, right. I mean, the people just don't realize like that this movie even exists. It's really a super, super fun movie. And yeah, they got Minnelli to direct it. I mean, can't go wrong. Joan Crawford again in Our Dancing Daughters. This is also a very, very early Joan Crawford performance. It's a silent film.
1928.
Wow. Yeah, 1928. Right on the cusp of moving to sound. And, you know, Joan Crawford, bigger star in the sound era than in the silent era. One of those who made the transition because it just favored her. But really very, very interesting if you only know Joan Crawford from her sound films. This one is worth checking out just for its historical value.
Mm-hmm.
Clark Gable, Jean Harlow, and Myrna Loy. What a trio that is in Wife Versus Secretary. This has been out on DVD a million times, and it's finally out on Blu-ray. James Stewart in a supporting performance. Really a very, very fun kind of... It's not a screwball comedy. It's kind of a screwball romance, but mm-hmm. it's very, mm-hmm. very fun. And they're all really wonderful.
The title, Wife Versus Today, it's not even a reference that makes any sense. But that was the thing all through, you know, sitcoms and everything. It was the secretary. Oh, your secretary. And ours.
Yeah.
It's all just not even you can't even do it.
Yeah. We've got Edward G. Robinson in Confessions of a Nazi Spy, which that title leaves nothing to the imagination. I wonder what this movie's about. This was one of the first really great propaganda films mm-hmm. that was made during World War II.
1939, technically before World War II. Well,
yeah. Before the U.S. entry to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was made right before war broke out, but war was inevitable. Mm-hmm. Like everyone knew it was coming. So Warner Brothers just figured we're just going to get in on this and, you know, fire the first salvo. So yeah, it was right there on the cusp, and it's benefited over the years ever since. Apparently it really was quite volatile that at the time. A lot of screenings were, you know, very heated during the period, because we forget, you know, there was a lot of, even before war broke out, a lot of people in the West supported Hitler. They thought he'd like found the magic formula.
Mr. Lindbergh, Mr. Ford, uh-huh. Mr. Ford, a whole lot
in the UK as well. That's the one of my favorite Merchant Ivory film, Remains of the Day, is very much about the that's the character that Fox plays in that movie is the one of those English aristocrats who wanted to try to bridge, you know, bring Mr. Hitler to and his ideas to the UK. I mean, it's mm-hmm. scary time when you look back on it. Mm-hmm. And Neptune's Daughter is just a delight. Red Skelton and Esther Williams. This is one of those great MGM Esther Williams vehicles. It's a whole lot of fun. It's one that is near and dear to me, obviously, because it dovetails with the, you know, Busby Berkeley. So I can't help but sort of appreciate what's going on here.
Anything with Xavier Cugat in it is all right with me.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then the last of the Warner Archive titles here is Robert Donat's Oscar-winning performance in Goodbye, Mr. Chips, mm-hmm. along with Greer Garson. They remade this as a musical with Peter O'Toole, which I am not as disdainful of as a lot of people, but I still think this original performance by Robert Donat is so unbelievably wonderful. He won Best Actor in 1939, ahead of so many others. Jimmy Stewart in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, ahead of Clark Gable in Gone with the Wind. I mean, he beat an incredible field, and very deservedly so, as this beloved teacher in this wonderful, mm-hmm. wonderful British boarding school melodrama. And I still think Goodbye, Mr. Chips is a fantastic classic and one of the best films of 1939.
Began my fandom of great teacher movies that goes on to this day and includes all kinds of wonderful movies that begins with Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Yeah. Let's hit some of the Criterion titles. And the Arrow titles as well. There's one main Arrow title here, Lover's Lane, one of those slasher films that from the slasher film era about an urban legend known as The Hook. You ever see this?
This is the one from 99, that John Stephen Ward film. I remember this movie.
John Ward. It's a kind of a late stage slasher film that has apparently gained a reputation, and I barely was aware of it at the time, but clearly it's enough of a thing that Arrow wanted to bring it back. Your opinion, is it deserving of its resurrected reputation?
Well, I remember this film from the day. Young Anna Faris is in this film, if I'm not mistaken. If it's a legacy of that, yeah, that was a good movie.
All right, so let's roll through some of these Criterion titles. First off is a film that won our LA Film Critics Best Film a few years ago, but was not eligible for Oscars for a whole bunch of dumb reasons. It was considered a TV miniseries, but it was promoted to us as a series of actual films, individual films, and we treated it as a single work, which I think you have to. But it is five films by Steve McQueen, Small Axe, which... is a chronicle of the lives and experiences of families and people with roots in the West Indies who are in the UK in the 70s and 80s. And it's a really interesting thing. It's not, what Steve McQueen wanted to do was to explore a particular UK culture, which is not, you can break it down. It's kind of like here in the US, you'll be the first person to certainly correct me and everybody else on this. It's not like everyone in the United States who's black is monolithic. Mm-mm. There are people from West Africa. There are people from East Africa. There are people who come from, in longstanding indigenous populations in the South, in places like New Orleans, those in the North with more New England, those who are part of the Great Migration, those who are Caribbean. I mean, these are a lot of different populations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in the UK, those who are from the West Indies are very different from those who have their roots in Africa and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's a really specific population, and their experience of the 70s and 80s is unique. And these five films, I would call a stone cold masterpiece. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's hard enough to make one film as an artist. All five of these films are amazing.
I'll let you go. Yeah, Steve directing all five episodes, a few different writers, and what was really interesting in watching these films is that while they're about these very particular black communities in London from like the late 60s stretching through the early 80s, depending on which episode you're watching. There are references in every single one of them that I found as an African American, born in the early 60s here in the United States, totally familiar, all of them, sometimes literally familiar, the music. If not that, the clothes, the tone, the style. They're all very interesting. Some of them are better than others, but they start at such a high level. I particularly like the one that's set at that house party, with that music.
Lover's Rock.
Lover's Rock. That's beautiful.
So good.
The one about the young boy who becomes a police officer and his father.
Red, white, and blue. Red, white, and blue. So good.
Another powerful, powerful one. All of them. And while they're all very individual, they are of a one. So you should simply watch the entire series.
Yeah, I you don't have to watch it all in one sitting, but no. it's really, really, absolutely incredible. John Boyega in Red, White, and Blue is so, so good. It's the best thing he's ever done, and it's such a deeply affecting story because it deals particularly that one with all of these conflicts, the conflict between education and public service, between the native born, which is what he is, and the immigrant, which is his parents.
Yeah.
The conflict between obviously, and this doesn't give anything away, but he could go on to a very successful career. in education, and instead he becomes a police officer because he wants to serve the community, and he realizes that there are racists on the police force who have been rough with the community, but it gets into conflicts within the community, within the family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so much drama in that story, and it's just beautifully shot. You know, McQueen was not my favorite director when he first started. He mm-hmm. felt like one of those pretentious Peter Greenaway former painters who comes to the movies and tries to do something, you know, tries to reinvent the wheel. Like, I think of Hunger and that shot of the guy mm-hmm. who's mopping the floor, which is like 4 minutes long, and I'm like, it's a 4 minute shot of a guy mopping a floor. What are you doing? Why are you doing this to me? You're killing me here. But then he became a storyteller, right? And then he started to understand he can be a painter when he's painting, but when you're making a movie, you're not a painter, you're a storyteller. And he now finds, you know, ways of shooting some of these scenes where he finds the place to put the camera, and he doesn't move it. And he lets the whole scene transpire in front of the camera without an edit in the most beautifully framed and staged and blocked way that possible. He really has become a very, very skilled filmmaker. And yeah. I just think this is one of the, I can't say enough about it.
He learned how to let the image serve the story. A few of them had to do that. Julian Schnabel had to, the butterfly and, the diving bell and the butterfly. But yes, Steve McQueen. Anyway, this is a good series. Yeah.
So we also have a bunch of Criterions on 4K. Here's what's on 4K from Criterion. Wings of Desire. Freaking Wim Wenders, whose movie, just another movie of his, won an award at Cannes just this last week. Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal. Freaking unbelievable. Because it's looked terrible on what they've had on Criterion Channel for a while. And The Fisher King. Oh my gosh, Robin Williams and Jeff Bridges for Terry Gilliam. And then lastly, Ruben Östlund's new film that just came out this last year was nominated for a ton of Oscars, including Best Picture, and also won the Palme d'Or, Triangle of Sadness. So let me just first start by saying, because maybe you like Triangle. I don't know if you and I have even talked about this movie. This movie to me is like a really unfunny version of The Love Boat that becomes an even less funny version of Gilligan's Island. I truly don't like this film. I respect Östlund as a director. I get it. He's won two Palme d'Ors. The Square one, I didn't like The Square either. I don't like this film at all. I don't know what people see in it. But maybe you do. You tell me. What's the deal with Triangle of Sadness?
Yeah, nothing, because I don't like it either. But it's also obvious to me. And is it funny? Okay, I giggle. But giggling, it's like giggling at somebody slipping on a banana. So, you know, all the crap that happens on the boat when all the food and all this kind of stuff like that. And here's the thing, you know, At the center of all of this is a sort of disdain for a certain kind of people. So whether we call them, whether it's the super rich or the super beautiful or the super whatever it is that you take it and you stick it in there, a disdain for them and all that they have and all that they do. Here's the thing. I don't have any disdain for the super rich. I don't have any disdain for the ridiculously beautiful. I don't have any disdain for anybody. In and of it, itself, nothing about anybody. There's a given kind of behavior that almost anybody can engage in that I would have disdain for, but nothing about you being rich or about you being pretty ever going to matter to me. Which is what these films, all of them, even that one, Look Up, it does. It confuses that. And I'm like, you want me to say that rich people are bad? I know lots of rich people. They aren't bad. But these rich people are assholes. But assholes are assholes, whether they have any money or not. And that's what these movies don't seem to get right. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It makes sense. And then for the others, I will just say that the 4K transfers of these combo sets of Seventh Seal, Fisher King, and Wings of Desire are superlative. You got to get them. Upgrade by any means necessary. And especially Wings of Desire. I just want to say I moderated an event with Wim Wenders some years ago. My wife has worked on a number of Wim Wenders films. She was the post-production supervisor on Buena Vista Social Club. So she's, you know, been very close to Wim over the years. When we were at the 50th anniversary Cannes Film Festival, that was for what film was it? End of Violence. So we went to the 50th anniversary Palm presentation because we were at the big red carpet for End of Violence. So I have a certain affection for Wim. Been on the set of several of his films here, including what was the one that they shot downtown? I can't even remember the name of it. The hotel movie. Million Dollar Hotel. Yeah. Million Dollar Hotel. Was it the wrap party for that? Gosh, I've been all over Vince's life. That's really weird. Still, I remember Jeremy Davies dancing up a storm at that rap party. But anyway, Wings of Desire, when I did the moderation thing, Henri Alacan, the cinematographer for this film, who is one of the greats of all-time international cinema, all the way back to Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, did all of those effects in camera. So when those wings are dissolving and disappearing and all this stuff is happening, there is no post-production special effects work happening in Wings of Desire. Alacan did that in real time in camera. That is old school hardcore. Just know that when you watch the film.
Yeah.
The last three criterions we got here, Seijin Suzuki's Branded to Kill is also on 4K. Forgot to mention that in the others. That's also available right now in a big Suzuki series on Criterion Channel. This is one of those great groovy kind of quasi-Japanese new wave slash Japsploitation films from 1967, a really great era. Everything was groovy and cool. Sexy. Tarantino riffs on a lot of this in Kill Bill, which is also now going to be coming out in 4K soon. This movie is one of the earliest Criterion's released. That's why it's number 38, and it's now in 4K, and it's so cool looking. The color is so cool. Targets, Bogdanovich's film, which was mentioned in our documentary Schlock, The Secret History of American Movies, the first film to really talk about spree killers and snipers and that whole horrible social phenomenon. Really interesting problem that he solved with Boris Karloff and how he used an old Corman movie to justify getting Corman to actually pay for funding this one. A lot of great stuff in here. There's an interview with Richard Linklater, an audio commentary from 2003 with Bogdanovich. This deserves to be on 4K. It's not on 4K. It's Blu-ray, but we'll live with it for now. It's wonderful to see Targets get the Criterion treatment. And Celine Sciamma's Petite Maman from about 2 years ago, kind of a big deal with Lafka, didn't really win any awards, but a lot of people loved this film.
I really did.
Brief film.
Yeah, I loved it.
It's great. It's like just barely 70 minutes long. Really kind of, you know, it's such a fascinating thing, this weird little mother-daughter relationship, time-bending thing that she does, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's a very sweet, simple, but incredibly original film. I don't know, tell what your thoughts.
Oh, it was just absolutely beautiful. Wonderfully done. Like, again, you don't want to give a whole lot away, but it gives you a sense of how things could be in more than one way. This is how it might feel in this way. But if it were like this, it might feel like this. And the film never really lets you know which one of these things is actually true.
We got some LGBT titles. Tim, I don't know if, did you have a chance to cover any of these?
Yeah, several of these. Like Me, for instance.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. E.L. Cantor, I think it is. It's funny, we talked about Dawson's Creek earlier. This has a whole lot in common with Dawson's Creek. It's just about this kid who's in school. He gets kicked out. He's working for this photographer, and they have this sort of intense relationship, and he's kind of, has a crush on his friend. And it's just this very gentle, very sweet little movie with a whole lot of great performances that I quite enjoyed. I got a chance to check out One Highway One. I don't know if there are any anything on any of these, so chime in if there's
no extras. No extras.
You're driving me crazy. Yeah. Anyway, Highway One's pretty good. It's about a New Year's Eve party. Almost all of it takes place in the same place. Jacqueline Bethany, and a couple of great performances there from some lovely young folks. And I also checked out Blood Red Ox, which is just a straight up South American rainforest film with a whole lot of mystical stuff going on behind the scenes, which is interesting because the film is really more about that than it is anything else, which was pretty good. And then this is beautiful one called Bean Thunder, which is set in the Native American community of up around Rhode Island. And it's just beautiful. And but it's set in this community where there are these a couple of kids, a queer kid, a straight kid, and this sort of transgender kid in this Native American community, and all of this stuff that's sort of going on. Yes, look, you wouldn't think to combine all of these things, but it's like it references. And I thought it was just perfectly lovely, perfectly lovely. We attend all of these ceremonies where they're wearing this Native American dress and just bright and beautiful stuff. It's really just sort of lovely, lovely. Stephanie Lattimore there in this film, and she's sort of like at the center of all of it. She's the young person who's there. So check that one out. It's a documentary.
All right. And let's see what else we've got here. We got some foreign films. We should probably get to The Quiet Girl is on DVD. That was nominated for an Oscar just this past year. The first ever Irish film that is in the Irish language. And it's funny, I was at a press event for this, and everyone kept asking the director and the people there, because they're like, what is the name of the Irish language? Is it like Gaelic, or is there, they're hoping that it's some name like Gilthrelgatel, or, you know, some Gaelic sounding thing. And everyone kept saying like, what do you call the Irish language? Like this, what's spoken in this film? What do you call it? And there was always a beat. And then the answer was always Irish. That's it. It's the Irish language. That's what it's called. It's Irish.
Yeah.
It's simpler than you would expect.
It's what it's called. It's what we are called. It's what the place is called. It's all the one thing. I love this movie. It was so sweet, and the title is so correct. Quiet Girl, and she goes to the family. She's sent shipped off. Her just goofy, these goofy parents, and they ship her off to live it's about how her family becomes sort of stabilized. Her sense of family becomes stabilized living with this old couple. And it's just beautiful. There's almost nothing that happens in this movie, you know?
It's a wonderful, it's like a slice of a sliver of life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really, it's very, very just intimate, incredibly nicely observed. And it, you know, that's the thing about movies, is that there's an assumption that when you're telling a story that you need to have a certain breadth. You need to start in a certain place and end in a certain place. And you only have 100 minutes, 120 minutes, maybe 150 minutes on the outside to make that journey. And when you do that, there are certain things that you just don't have time to observe along the way. And the nice thing about Colm Baryad, who wrote and directed this, is that he just decided, you know what? I'm just not going to step that far back. I'm going to get in really very detailed, finely observed, and I'm going to just make a whole movie about a much more simple and quiet and intimate trajectory than what would normally be considered an acceptable feature film. And it's so refreshing. It really is. I just wish it was on Blu-ray. I wish they'd have done a Blu-ray of it, but you know, I'll take the DVD. The Oscar-winning Indochine is also out, finally, on Blu-ray from Sony Pictures Classics. Régis Varnier never got nominated again, but still a very, you know, epic director, makes a lot of big movies, has made a lot of big movies in France. Anyway, Indochine, big melodrama, you know, Catherine Deneuve and the other actor whose name is escaping me at the moment.
Vincent Perez.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Along with, you know, Lin Dan Pham and Jean Yan, all takes place during the French Indochinese period. And Catherine Deneuve is the owner of this, you know, very successful rubber plantation. And then it gets into the, you know, the communist uprising, which turns into the Indochinese War, which of course turns into the American Vietnam. But a tremendous movie, really a tremendous movie. And it's very interesting too, a little story about how it became the Oscar winner. There are always arguments in countries like France, which have very established film industries, which movie you're going to submit for consideration in the what was then Best Foreign Language is now the Best International Film. And at the time, this year, because I remember I had lived in France just shortly before, there was a huge debate over whether or not it would be Indochine, which they considered the more commercial and international choice, or All the Mornings of the World, Tous les Matins du Monde, starring Gérard Depardieu, which is all about this very obscure quasi-like cello instrument, which is almost extinct now. Almost no one uses it. I forget the exact name of it. It's like the violoncello or something like that. And it's a string instrument that very few pieces are performed anymore. And this movie is about that instrument and the drama that goes on with a master of it and all this stuff. And anyway, beautiful period film, but the soundtrack for that film, which is all of this Baroque string music, was like a number one album seller in France that year. And so a lot of people in the French film industry thought, oh, we got to submit this one. And the sensible people said, you realize this movie is popular with no one but people in France. It is so parochial. I get it that everyone in France loves this movie, but the Oscars will not love this movie. The Oscars will, however, love Indochine because it predicts the American quagmire in Vietnam. They'll connect to it in a more global sense. They prevailed, and sure enough, it won the Oscar. So, you know, that's the story of Indochine. It's a very, very interesting story. Let's see. Goliath by Frederick Tellier. Did you see Goliath?
Did I see Goliath? Which one are we talking about?
So Goliath by Frederick Tellier, really, really tough cop story about this, about a school teacher whose husband is poisoned by pesticides, and it turns into kind of an anti-chemical. Anyway, it's kind of
what was that one that Julia Roberts made back in the with the, where she's, you know, and they're poisoning the water. Aaron Brockovich. Yeah.
So it's like if you had Aaron Brockovich, but with just a grittier edge to it. And it's like a much more, you know, I mean, it's almost like somewhere between an Aaron Brockovich and a, well, how do I even put it? It's just a really interesting film. I mean, it's a little bit of a police thriller, but it's a little bit of an environmental thriller at the same time, if that makes sense. So it kind of splits the difference between the two. It was screened at the French Film Festival in the UK. I wish it had been screened at our Kolkoa, which is no longer called Kolkoa. But anyway, it's a really good film. Goliath, worth checking out. Gilles Lelouch, who I love as an actor, is just tremendous in it as well. Really, really a tough, tough, good film. Oh, Leonore Will Never Die. Leonore Will Never Die. This is by Martica Ramirez Escobar. And it is a completely crazy comedy. This is from Music Box Films. And it's a comedy, the one where the chick
gets the TV on her head. This is funny.
It's a Filipino comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Filipino industry is very, very small. But yeah, go ahead.
If she's this filmmaker, she gets this TV, it falls on her head. It's extremely hysterically funny. And she becomes this action hero. But she's like this old lady. And that's what makes it absolutely hysterical. That was very, very good. Sometimes these Filipino comedies are really, really just very sharp.
I got another one here by a filmmaker named Hadas Ben Arroya, which is All Eyes Off Me. And this is an Israeli film from Film Movement. Comes with a really, really great little short film on here called Daddy's Girl by Lena Hudson. Really, really terrific, which is an American film, an American short film that won the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival. So the short film, I would almost say, is reason enough to pick this up. It's terrific. Daddy's Girl is really, really good. But as an Israeli film, All Eyes Off Me is one of those great little gritty Israeli youth movies that deals with some of the tougher parts of Israeli culture that they may not necessarily want exported, but it's there are unwanted pregnancies in Israel too. I know nobody wants to sort of admit that, but that happens there. All those things happen there, and you have kids who are, you know, and young people who are getting themselves into trouble and life situations that they do everywhere else too. And you know, the awkwardness of those relationships—that's kind of the center of this. You've got, all of that, all those awkward things, and all of the sexual politics that go along with that are a part of Israeli culture as well. So, All Eyes Off Me is also well worth checking out. Let's see. Everything went fine. I'm going to make a mention of this because it's Cohen, and I'm fond of everybody at Cohen, but also because it has Sophie Marceau in it, and she's ageless. François Ozon, who we always love, directed Sophie Marceau and Charlotte Rampling and André Dussolier in this just really, really fascinating movie. Hannah Scheigler,
the movie. It's a beautiful movie.
It's, you know, Ozon just never stops making great movies, and he makes so many of them. I mean, it's just a family reconciliation drama, but everyone in it is just on their game, just so on their game. I mean, your thoughts?
Well, this is one of those old guy who's a great guy, and he has a 85 years old, and he has a stroke, and he has this daughter who's bananas about him, and he wants her to, you know, help him finish it all, and she's struggling with all of that. And it's just a sort of beautiful movie, and it sort of works through all of this through this excellent set of performances by just everybody here, and it's sweet, and it's moving, and it doesn't particularly land on any answers. It's just a really, really neat movie. Charlotte Rampling's in it, and Sophie Marceau, as you say, and it's really, really good. Great performance by, what's his name, André, who plays the father?
Dussolier. Dussolier.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Let's see if I've got any others that I want to make mention of real fast, because we're getting close to time here. Just a few. Quickly here. Philip Stozel's Chess Story, which is based on a novel by Stefan Zweig. This is also from Film Movement and takes place in Vienna in that tempestuous late 30s moment just before World War II, when the Nazis have already executed the Anschluss and they've absorbed Austria, and it is now under complete and total Nazi occupation and control. And it stars Oliver Masucci as a doctor who's about to just run, and he wants no more part of it. But then before he can get to America, you know, like they do in the end of The Sound of Music, right, he can't get out of the country, so he's arrested by the Gestapo. And he has knowledge that they want. And so now you get into this really interesting battle where they try to squeeze him in solitary confinement for everything that they can. And he saves himself from the horror of that moment through chess. And it's such a fascinating look, not at chess, but at how people can find strategies for keeping themselves sane in insane moments and circumstances. It's really very, very well done. It's really very, very interesting. And you know, Philip Stozel is quite an accomplished filmmaker. So great cast, terrific production value, good. And it also has a bonus short film by Christoph Daniel and Mark Schmidaini called Der Tunnel, meaning the tunnel, in case you didn't know that. So it's a interesting thing takes place on a train and through a train tunnel. Anyway, Chess Story on DVD, not on Blu-ray, worth checking out. And the Joseph Sarno Retrospect series from Film Movement Classics has a new double feature on it, Moonlighting Wives and the Naked Fog. Sarno, kind of an artsy exploitation figure. These are not great movies, but they are kind of salacious, but they're salacious and erotic in a very artful way, or at least a way that believes that it's artful. So this is strictly for fans of Sarno and his particular body of work. But Moonlighting Wives and the Naked Fog.
Joe Santos. I love Joe. Yeah. Joe is in a lot of Rockford Files, a lot of.
Yeah.
He pops up in these movies. Love Joe.
Yeah. It's good. Good. Some interesting cast surprises there. And I'll do these last three here. Eric Gravel made a movie called Full Time, which stars Laura Calami as a single mother who is, and this is a thing in these French independent films, the travails of single moms and working moms. There are a number of these movies. It's almost like a subgenre. Anyway, she's just got this unbelievably horrible situation where she has to work and drop the kids off and do all of this stuff every single day. And it almost becomes like the film is really anxiety inducing. She's trying to get a new job. She's working at this food establishment, but she's trained for a better job and she's interviewing with corporations, but she has to somehow conform her kid's schedule to the demands of the job and she's got to travel. And then she has to run back and pick up and she's got to call her buddy who's, you know, pick my kids up. I'm not going to be back in time. I just missed the train. I mean, it's all of this kind of anxiety inducing, juggling every ball that you can possibly imagine. It's really, really kind of just a grueling movie to watch, but it's bracing, and her performance, Laura Calami, is amazing in this performance because somehow she just, you know, considering that they shot this thing, you know, when you shoot a movie, it's a pretty casual, you get out there, all right, take one, take two. And then you have to bring the anxiety in the moment of the take so that when it all edits together, it's seamless anxiety. So when you realize the extent of her performance, I mean, she must have just gone on the treadmill for like 5 minutes before every take because she never stops panting. It's a really, really good movie.
Oh,
Full
yeah.
Time is what it's called.
Yep.
And then Return to Seoul. This got a lot of love during our LAFCA voting as well. Were you a fan of this?
I was a fan of the movie. It's about this young woman who does exactly that. She was adopted out during that period when a lot of that was happening from South Korea, both of the Koreas, but certainly South Korea, to here in the United States and to families in Paris. So you would have these Korean children adopted out to these French parents, and she has this opportunity to return to Seoul, to go to Seoul for the first time since she was a baby, actually, and happens to meet her birth parents, and then this film unfolds, and it's very interesting film, very powerful, very emotional. It was a couple of really great performances, but particularly from Park, Jim, Ming. They're really great. It's a very, very moving and interesting film because it becomes a film that you do not think that it sets out to be. It just sort of happens the way it sort of happens. It's very interesting.
I liked it too. I wasn't sure how I felt about it at the time we were voting. It's one of those things that had to kind of grow on me. But anyway, yeah, it's out on Blu-ray from Sony Pictures Classics. And then lastly, only on Blu-ray, also from Film Movement, but quite good, is another French film called A Bag of Marbles by Christian Duguay. Also, you know, based on a novel, I also wish this was on Blu-ray because it has just absolutely beautiful period production value. Another World War II era thing. We're never going to run out of World War II era stories. But it takes place during the Nazi occupation of Paris. Mm. And it's one of these wonderful movies about how the innocence of childhood and the resilience of children can kind of survive under inclement conditions. Not playing chess, not learning from chess, but just the strength of children, which we often underestimate. And this little 10-year-old kid who, you know, doesn't little 10-year-old Jewish kid. Here's the premise here is that he. Well, I won't say it. The bag of marbles is significant. I won't say what the bag of marbles represents and what goes on with it. But the bag of marbles is both a real story device and then also a symbol. And it's quite beautiful about how this precipitates this family's attempt to escape and flee and get to what then is the area of Vichy France, which is the free zone of France that was still overseen by the Nazis, but was given a limited degree of self-rule and autonomy. Mm. Anyway, it's based on an autobiography by Joseph Jaffo, and it's really a beautiful, beautiful movie. Deserves to be on Blu-ray. Please put this out on Blu-ray. Mm. Bag of Marbles. I'm sure we'll get it at some point. All right. With that, let's bring the show to a close. I'll try not to wait so many weeks until the next one. Anything planned?
We had to get out in the world. We had to get out in the world and do some stuff. So
have to do some stuff. A lot of stuff. Still got a lot of stuff going on. More than I can possibly count. You got anything planned for the early part of the summer?
Not a whole lot. May roam around back and forth. My niece is in New York, so I might go to where you just came from to visit with her. But you know, kind of going to check out these big summer movies and see what's what. What are you thinking? What are you feeling? How's it feeling out there to you?
Here's what's feeling to me. Well, funny, we talked about this on Film Week this week. You know, what are we looking at with the summer movies? I think a lot of stuff's going to do well. I don't think anything is going to do as well as they think it will. Mm. Obviously, people are looking at Elemental from Pixar. They're looking at The Flash. Those open on the same day. Mm. They're looking at a number of things. The Indiana Jones film. I don't think any of that is going to perform like people are thinking it will.
Mm.
But I'll tell you
Thinking or hoping it will.
I think they're hoping that those movies will perform on blockbuster level like previous films have. I don't think this summer is there yet. I don't think audiences are there yet. I don't think the movies necessarily will warrant it. I think people are, you know, the Spider-Man movie is going to open big, but I think people are a little fatigued with a lot of these things. But you know what last year taught me was there's one thing people are not fatigued with, and that is Mr. Tom Cruise.
Yeah,
and for that reason, I think Mission Impossible, which is the first of a two-part kind of concluding chapter to the Mission Impossible films, I think that thing is going to blow the doors off of everything else this year. I have watched those trailers. I can't get enough of them. They get me so excited. And, you know, he rode a motorcycle off a cliff, bro. He rode a motorcycle off a cliff. That's not CGI. That's Tom Cruise sitting around going, what have I not done in my career yet? I'm 60. What's on my bucket list? I know. I'll ride a motorcycle off a cliff. That's a little crazy. Yeah. But, I do think that what they have planned in that film is something amazing. And if you read that story, which I think was in The Atlantic, about how the pandemic, remember Tom Cruise lost his mind while on set shooting this thing, yelling at everybody, you know, wear your masks and, you know, we're good. Because everybody was kind of getting down on him for being kind of, well, look, he's the producer of a movie which was budgeted at like $200 million and wound up costing about $300 million.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that money is on his shoulders. And the insurance company is all over this. Everybody has something riding on this. You got to understand, that's not a prima donna star losing his mind. That is a responsible producer insisting that people be professional and not put that production at risk for everyone else. And he quite rightly raised the point. This movie needs to happen. It can't get shut down because, not because of me, not because I need all this money, but because all of these people here, these electricians and these gaffers and these grips, these are working class people who need this movie to happen during the pandemic to be able to pay their mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good man. That's a responsible filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I have every hope that this movie, over budget and over schedule as it was all over the globe, I think it's going to blow up, and it deserves to. And I'm rooting for it.
I'm rooting for it too. Look, he's the CEO of what I like to call one of the industries of Hollywood. We think of Hollywood as an industry. Hollywood is an industry, but within the Hollywood industry, there are industries, and these industries of Hollywood include that Mission Impossible franchise.
Yep.
You know, a 25 year old. There are whole companies that come and go in less than 25 years. Nobody buys a BlackBerry anymore. But there are industries of Hollywood, that Fast and Furious set of films that have done exactly what you said, and generally at the top of these industries of Hollywood is a CEO, and Tom Cruise is one of those CEOs.
Yep, indeed, absolutely, indeed. All right, with that, we are done, and we will catch you guys on the next show.